My name's Millie Lake. I'm a researcher for the Brand Responsibility Oral and Digital History Project. Today is the 18th of November 2010. If you could just please state your name and title for the record.
I'm Naseem Prakash, Professor of Political Science at University of Washington.
Okay, thank you. Could you perhaps start by just telling us a little bit about your role here at the University of Washington, your position and how you came to be here?
I'm a professor in the Department of Political Science. In that capacity, I was invited to serve on university's licensing advisory committee that advises the president on various negotiations pertaining to vendors that want to use the university logo.
Okay, thank you. Could you tell us a little bit about your role on the Advisory Trademarks and Licensing Committee, what your responsibilities are, how often the committee meets, what kind of issues come before the committee?
Yeah, I'm a member of the committee, which is co-chaired by Margaret Levy and a student representative. I think that spot is vacant as of now. The previous student has moved on. And we meet, depending on the urgency of the situation, every month or every other month, and we deliberate on the issues that are brought to our notice. Anybody can bring issues to our notice, or we ourselves can propose things on the agenda. So it's fairly open. It's a public meeting. Anybody and everybody is welcome to attend it. They just have to inform Kathy, who's the manager of the committee, if I may use that phrase, in advance. And then they could very well attend and offer comments and suggestions, also mainly as observers.
Okay, thank you very much. How long have you served on the committee, and what raised your interest in trademarks and licensing issues?
My research pertains to the role of trade in diffusing social standards, and I have done some work on labor issues as well. So I think what I write on directly pertains to what the committee is trying to do, use the power of University of Washington as the consumer, as the end consumer, to ask for changes in the supply chain. And that's precisely what I write on. I think this is my third year on the committee. I don't exactly remember, but it seems I've been on it for a long time.
Okay. Thank you. So we want to talk a little bit about the recent settlement between Nike and CGT pertaining to the factory closures of Haga and Vision Techs in Honduras in 2009. And we understand this is a matter that came before the committee. Could you talk a little bit about that, about when this particular issue first came to your attention and what the key issues were as you perceived them?
This issue came to our attention, I think, a year ago. I don't remember the exact date. And at least from my perspective, it's a very, very clear-cut issue. The code of conduct that Nike is a signatory to obligates Nike to assume responsibility of the actions of its supply chain, of its subcontractors. And the allegation was that Nike subcontracted in Honduras closed down factories without giving workers their legally required compensation. And we merely wanted Nike to honor the code of conduct that it signed on to. And we were using our power as a customer of Nike to make sure that Nike takes this forward and asks his subcontractors to do so. So it was not a very complicated issue in my mind. The complication that arose primarily stemmed from two or three factors. First, the code of conduct is not very clear, and it needs to be strengthened to make sure that Nike or any other signatory understands the obligations pertains to the supply chain as well. From our perspective, it's irrelevant. At least that's the way I think, whether Nike owns the factory in Honduras or it has subcontracted. It is obligated to honor labor rights. So this was the first source of controversy. And this is precisely what Nike exploited. And their initial reaction was that they have no control over the subcontractors and they are doing whatever is possible, and the subcontractors are bankrupt, so they don't have the financial resources, and so on and so forth. So I think it stemmed from a different interpretation about the extent to which Nike is obligated to enforce the code of conduct in supply chain.
Okay, thank you. Could you talk a little bit more then about the specifics of the code of conduct, the specific aspects that Nike were in violation of, and you mentioned that the code needed to be strengthened, so just say a little bit about
I think there are two issues. First, Nike needs to provide data at regular intervals on its suppliers, and Nike did not do so. And second is the issue of respecting workers' rights. And I think the code of conduct identifies what are the rights that need to be respected and honored. As I said, the controversy or the misunderstanding or the confusion is whether or the extent to which Nike as the basic supplier is obligated to enforce these in its supply chain. So I think these were the two core issues. There was a concern raised by a committee member that they don't want developed countries to enforce the standards in developing countries. I don't agree with that argument, but it was certainly a perspective that was offered.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that a little bit later, but perhaps since you've raised it, we could talk a little bit about that now. Could you maybe explain why what your perspective is on that issue and why you don't think that developing countries should, or why you don't agree with that position?
Yeah, my position is very clear. I think there are certain rights that need to be honored across boundaries, and labor rights are one of them. And the purpose of the conduct is precisely that as customers and consumers, we use our purchasing power to spread our preferred norms. And the norms we collectively hold in this university is that rights of the workers have to be honored. And I don't think there is anything unreasonable or this is a form of imperialism or something of that kind. I think it's fairly straightforward. It's an issue of human rights. And if the Honduran government is failing to enforce its own law, that makes it even more imperative to use our purchasing power. So I think I have a different perspective from at least one member of the committee.
Okay. And do you believe it takes any, the impetus on multinational corporations to be active on this issue in domestic context takes any responsibility away from the domestic government? Is there any way to balance those two?
I don't think it's either or. I think both have to work together. But if the government is failing to fulfill its obligation, that should not give the multinational corporation free ride.
Okay. Thank you. So maybe we could return to the decision, the unanimous decision reached by the actual committee to make a recommendation to President Emmett. Could you tell us a little bit about that process, about how the committee came to reach that decision and... What the procedure was in reaching the unanimous
recommendation? Yeah, I think there were two decisions. The first decision was to put Nike on notice for violation. And the process of the committee is we take an open vote. So people raise hands and somebody proposes a motion. Uh-huh. The person seconds it. It was a unanimous decision, if I recall correctly. And on the basis of the committee's decision, the co-chair of the committee drafted a letter to President Emmert, who was very prompt in acknowledging the letter and then writing to Nike. The second decision was, once Nike said, in response to President Emmert's letter, that it will not, or it's not in a position to force subcontractors to honor the law, and it provided some less than satisfactory avenues, that it would create a retraining fund and things of that kind. The committee deliberated, we were obviously dissatisfied, And then one idea came that Nike's contract is up for renewal. And what if we recommend to the president that the contract not be renewed? And I think, given the media coverage and given the momentum it seemed to be developing, Nike agreed. So it was very interesting to see how a sustained campaign, even in the light of a pushback from a major corporation, eventually brings a corporation to see at least the reality as we see it. And it was, I think, the way I see it, it was a purely instrumental decision on the part of the corporation, because the reputational loss and the infamy they would achieve by persisting in their, I think, indefensible position was not put there by.
Okay, thank you. And I believe there were some discussions about the decision of whether or not to terminate the contract with Nike. Could you say a little bit about whether that was discussed in actual meetings and what the perspective was on that?
Yeah, I think the broader discussion is that Nike is not perfect, but Nike is still better than many other suppliers. And we should create an incentive for a supplier to continually improve while recognizing that perfection is often difficult to achieve. And if Nike undertakes, or Russell for that matter, which is another company, undertakes something positive, but which is not perfect, we should not have such heavy sanctions that the company believes that no good deed goes unpunished. So the controversy, and we have not been able to, or we have been able to some extent, find a system of graduated incentives and punishments, so that the company has a continual incentive to improve and to comply better with the code of conduct. So there was some controversy, are we being too harsh, or are we not being harsh enough? And I think people come from different perspectives on the committee, and this is what you expect. So it's lack of unanimity on some issues does not bother me. I think it's a sign of healthy debate.
Okay. So on that note, could you talk a little bit about your interaction with students? I know the Student Labour Action Project was represented on the committee and were very active on this issue. Did you have any personal interaction with that group?
No, I did not.
Okay.
I did not. My interaction was purely limited to the committee meetings, of course. There was a student who was in my class, and we would briefly talk about that. But in terms of actively participating in activism, I did not.
Okay. And from the student representation on the committee, could you tell us a little bit about the role that you perceive to have been played by student activism in this process?
I think the whole process of establishing a committee and forcing Nike was primarily driven by student activism. So they certainly had a very important role to get the ball rolling. But I also think in the last 1 or 2 years, students have become de-radicalized. And there was a point in time last year where we could not, as students themselves admitted, that they are not able to generate enough enthusiasm for protests and for a sustained campaign. So there are probably phases. And if there's an egregious abuse that gets media attention, students are more motivated. And other times it's not. But I think on the whole it's a positive role.
Okay, thank you. The other issue that many of the students had raised concern about was the decision by Phyllis Wise to accept a position on the Nike board. I wondered if you were able to talk at all about your position on that.
I think it's a double-edged sword. First of all, I don't question the integrity. I think Phyllis Wise is a very honorable person and has the interest of university at heart. And when the controversy cropped up, she also responded in the sense of donating all the proceeds from her position to, I think, a scholarship fund or something of that kind. So I don't think it's an issue of clash of interest. And one could also say that probably Phyllis Wise can achieve more by being on the board than being outside. But having said this, the timing of the decision did raise some issues. But I think eventually everything has worked out, and I think all important stakeholders are happy with the outcome.
Okay. Thank you. You talked a little bit about the response from Nike after President Emmett submitted the initial letter expressing concern, and I believe Nike had taken various different positions throughout this process. Could you talk a little bit about those positions?
Yeah, like essentially there are two phases in Nike. Phase one is pushback.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when we put them on notice, and they said they will not put pressure on the Honduran subcontractor, and they have got no legal obligation under the code of conduct. And apparently a very senior official of Nike also visited the university and told president or somebody in person. So it was at that time it seemed that Nike will not be using its muscle power to enforce the code of conduct. But in phase two, when the proposal was made that we don't renew their contract instead of cancelling their contract, and the fact that we got coverage in the New York Times, and it seemed that this could potentially snowball into a major controversy, also with the recession, people losing jobs, I don't think Nike would look very pretty if it were portrayed as a greedy company that is not even willing to fulfill the legal obligations. Because I think what the committee was asking was very reasonable. We were just asking the subcontractors to fulfill their legal obligations. I think Nike capitulated. So there are two phases, which at least to me seems that a sustained campaign is necessary, and one should not get disheartened by the initial pushback. And the second learning is that we need to tighten our code of conduct so that there is no ambiguity in the future.
Yeah, on that note, I believe there was some discussion over, or some controversy over whether Husky goods were themselves produced in the factories, the subcontracting factories. Did that matter to you? Or
no, there is, that what constitutes subcontractor, because a typical subcontractor is supplied to various vendors. So what is the cutoff? What is the contamination level that turns a subcontractor into a Husky subcontractor? And I think these are the issues we need to specify. There has to be a threshold beyond which any subcontractor would be considered a Husky subcontractor over a period of time, because there is also a time dimension that are we talking over 1 year, in 2 years, etc., etc. So there is, I think, the code of conduct needs to be strengthened and these ambiguities eliminated.
Okay. So just to stick with this point for one more moment, as we understand, if the contract had continued to expire and Nike hadn't taken any action, the Nike is still responsible for supplying the sports team. It's just the contract that we're talking about is just relating to the goods supplied in the bookstore and not the...
That's right. Those are two different things.
Okay.
This only pertains to the apparel and other things that are sold through the bookstore.
Okay. And how...
CLC, it's something called Collegiate Licensing Committee or something.
And how did Actel at any point discuss this tension between having Nike remain as a contractor for the sports team and then having the contract expire?
There's no tension at all.
Okay.
Because we have a representative from the athletic department, and the representative made it very clear they want to do the right thing.
Okay.
So I think we can say with pride that there was no tension at all.
Okay. Alright, that's interesting. And do you know if the contract had continued to expiration and Nike hadn't taken any action, was it discussed what alternative action the university might have taken, so where they might have sourced their goods from in the future? Or was that a matter before Actel?
Yeah, I think Nike doesn't have a problem with sourcing goods. So that was never an issue that our supply will dry up and the students wanting to buy a University of Washington jersey would not be able to buy one. So that's never been an issue.
Okay. I was thinking of, had Nike not been a any longer a contractor of the university than were any other brands discussed. I know there was talk of Alta Gracia lately, but they're probably not yet equipped to supply that
right.
kind of order. So
Alta Gracia has come up later on. It was not part of the discussion when the Nike controversy was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we examined that alternative or scenario
okay.
where Nike would pack up and leave.
Okay. So you were, as a committee, fairly optimistic that Nike would have eventually succumbed to the pressure?
Yeah, it's not Nike, somebody else would supply apparel. These
okay.
are low technology products, and there are quite a few vendors who would be willing to supply that.
Okay.
So the bargaining position actually favors us rather than favoring Nike.
Okay. And could you talk a little bit about where your primary sources of information came from throughout the decision process? So where was Aftal getting its information? Where were you getting your information?
Yeah, I think the committee was getting information from the workers, directly from the workers, from WRC, from FLA,
okay.
and many members of the committee are fairly networked. They were constantly in touch with other universities that were contemplating similar decisions. Yeah, and I think Angelina Godoy was an important source of information. So there were a variety of sources of information, of course.
Okay. Hold on a second, I think we've covered many of my questions already. Yeah, I believe other universities also played an important role in the negotiations with Nike in placing pressure on the company to take the action that they ended up taking. Were you in contact with any other universities, or what was your knowledge of the actions taken by other universities?
Yeah, I think it was really Wisconsin and Cornell.
Okay.
And Wisconsin was probably the first university to put Nike on notice. This is phase one, when Nike was still adamant about not enforcing the code of conduct. And then slowly, I think it was Cornell that took the decision, or it was time to take the decision, I don't exactly remember. But I must say, the message we were getting, or at least I was perceiving, was that this is not on the agenda of most universities.
Okay.
And University of Washington is one of the few that's willing to confront Nike. So there was a very serious collective action problem there.
So why do you think that was, that University of Washington took such a leadership role on this issue as opposed to any other school?
I can't say about other schools because I don't know what their institutional structure is,
okay.
who populates those committees. But I think in our context, everybody in the committee felt strongly
yeah.
that this was an important issue, and these are the sorts of issues that we are obliged to act upon.
Okay. So you think that the committee... the existence of an advisory trademarks and licensing committee at the University of Washington was really critical in ensuring that the university played this kind
not
of leadership.
The existence of the committee, but it being populated by the individuals that are on the committee.
Okay, that's helpful, thank you.
Because all these meetings and all they take time.
Yeah.
Everybody has busy schedules, but still people turn up for meetings,
yeah.
they spend quality time, they contemplate. Discuss. So I think it's a serious investment on the part of the committee members.
Is there any way you can think of that communication between universities could be improved in order to facilitate these kinds of this kind of action in the process in the future?
But I think I propose and other committee members have proposed that we need to have some kind of an annual meeting where if not all universities but the key universities that have this licensing process need to get together and exchange notes and develop a common strategy. And apparently there are certain forums or fora where this happens, but that is incidental.
Okay.
So this needs to get more institutionalized. I think President Emmert was planning to be in touch with presidents of PAC-10 or something on this issue. I don't exactly remember what. But one of the ideas and proposals was that the University of Washington can take leadership position on the subject.
Okay. That's really helpful. I lost my train of thought again. Hold on. Just bear with me for 1 second. I wondered if you could maybe, in the meantime, talk just again about the code of conduct. In many of the other meetings, people have raised the kind of issues relating to the intent of the code and its intentional ambiguity. And I know you've talked about this a little bit already, but do you feel that the code... do you know when the code was first drafted and how...
No, I was not involved with drafting. And I think it's been... I don't know exactly when it was drafted.
Okay, sorry. I think we've covered most of the questions that I had. Is there any... are there any other issues that you feel you'd like to share for the public record that I haven't covered already?
Oh,
there was one other thing actually. I wanted to talk about the final settlement package. I understand there were various components to the final settlement, including the lump cash sum that was paid to workers, health benefits, priority rehiring. Were there any aspects of that final settlement that you wish had been included that weren't, or were you fairly happy with the outcome?
I think it was a reasonable outcome.
Okay.
It was a reasonable outcome.
Okay, and I know there has been some concern expressed about the wording of the settlement in order to ensure that it doesn't set any kind of legal precedent for the future. And I wondered if you had any opinions on that.
I have not heard that concern.
Okay.
So I don't know.
I believe that Nike was fairly careful to word the settlement package in such a way that that excused them from any legal responsibility to pay the workers, so it was seen as an act of good faith rather than a legal obligation.
Yes, and that's why I think we need to strengthen the code of conduct.
Okay.
So no matter how cleverly these settlements are worded, mm-hmm. if you make it very clear that if you are selling to the University of Washington, you or your subcontractors are obligated to fulfill all the legal requirements of the country where it's produced.
Okay.
And if the subcontractors don't, then the supplier has to.
Burdenful.
So I think if we remove that ambiguity from the code of conduct, all this legal smartness will not help the suppliers.
Yeah, that's important. And with that in mind, do you think in it, despite Nike's best efforts to avoid this kind of precedent, do you think that the decision will inevitably set a precedent for the future?
Absolutely. So now the precedent has been set. It may not have been set in legal terms, but it has been set.
Yeah.
And now it's very clear that if universities get their act together, and if an active name and shame campaign can be orchestrated, suppliers will honor the code of conduct, both in its letter and intent.
Okay. And just to return to one final point that you talked about before about the students having been de-radicalized, do you see that will continue in the future, or do you think there's possibilities for students to be mobilized by this kind of outcome?
I think these are also unusual times. There is a very serious recession. People are insecure. So I haven't lost hope on students. I think in different set of circumstances, and probably a more provocative issue,
mm-hmm.
students will become more radical. And radical in a positive sense. By radical I don't mean anarchists, but organizing collective action for something which is reasonable and just.
Yeah, because it seems like the members of the Student Labour Action Project that we've spoken to so far, and from our other interviews with other faculty members, that those particular students were fairly radical on this issue and very persistent, and that was really key to the outcome, in a sense. And so I guess I was just wondering if the problem was for them to garner wider support among the student population at the University of Washington, or whether their stance in itself wasn't as radical as it could have been.
Yeah, I think these are very unusual times.
Okay.
And I think there is a general decrease in enthusiasm across each areas, not only among students, almost everybody. So my hope is as the economy stabilizes and picks up,
yeah,
some of that vigor and interest will be back.
Okay. All right, well, thank you very much for your time.